You've tuned in to 96.7 on your FM dial. This is CKLU, and the program is QOL, Quality of Life. Your host, me, Hugh Cruzell. You can also listen asynchronously instead of Thursdays at 6 o'clock. Of course, the opportunity is to listen to Radio Garden. If you're out there in the world, you just rotate the globe to, well, Canada, Ontario, Sudbury, 96.7 CKLU. You know, podcasts are always available asynchronous to this whole system. Your time, your convenience. My guest today, you know, we're talking about quality of life and, you know, how you present yourself to the world, how everything just sort of happens and you're a person and, you know, people see you and they judge you on how you look and how you, well, what's happened to you. And, you know, Christy Russo is part of a project and it's essential in providing children who have had nothing to do in any of this. It is not their fault. There they are and they've, Christy, what has happened to them?
So here at Operation Smile, we are helping fund surgeries for children born with a condition called a cleft condition. So that's affecting either their lip, their palate, or both. And it's typical, we're funding surgeries around the world in low and middle income countries for children and families who can't afford surgery or have no access to surgery.
I have to ask this question. I mean, how much does it cost to fix? I don't even know if the right word is fix. You know, you probably have a vocabulary that I don't even know yet because it's a challenge, isn't it?
It is, but the cleft palate and cleft lip surgeries are fairly simple surgeries and what would be considered part of an essential surgery around the world. The problem is that about 5 billion people in this world don't have access to essential and simple surgeries. So a cleft lip could cost as little as $240, and the surgery takes as little as 45 minutes to complete.
You're kidding. That's not a long time in terms of surgery
it's
or
not,
cost.
No, it's not. And of course, that cost really varies country to country. And we're able to keep our costs down here at Operation Smile because all of our surgeons and other medical professionals are volunteering their time to help those children as well. But really, it is a small cost when you think about something that will change a child's life, change not only, as you mentioned, you know, how they look and how people perceive them, but also just their health and well-being. Many children born with cleft conditions don't have the ability to eat or come to us malnourished, have a lot of problems with language, speech, and other things throughout their lives. So it really is life-changing, and we create those smiles.
Are you... I didn't realize it. I mean, obviously, if one looks, you see the potential for problems with embouchure, the shaping of the lips to make sounds. I mean, let's face it. Do we here in Sudbury, because we are both here in Sudbury, do we know that this happens here? Is it repaired instantly as a child is? I mean, what's the ideal age? I have so many questions.
Sure. Yeah, there are children born with cleft conditions in all countries around the world. Here in Canada, typically that would be noticed in one of mom's ultrasounds. And then a plan would be put in place even before the baby is born. And most surgeries happen at our large children's hospitals. So here in Ontario, if a child was born in Sudbury, for example, Sudbury, we would be referred to the Sick Kids
in Toronto.
Program. So yeah, the cleft clinic at Sick Kids in Toronto.
They have a clinic.
Yeah, they have the cleft clinic there, and it's led by one of our volunteer surgeons as well. So Dr. David Fisher, he's a volunteer for Operation Smile, and he's the head of the cleft care clinic there at Sick Kids. Baby, typically, like I said, there's a plan in place as soon as, even before they're born. Some taping will happen to help grow some of the skin.
Together, on their lip. Yes.
And yeah, a surgery can happen before they're 3 months old in Canada. And the palate surgery, which the palate is what really affects speech cues. So if you think of every time you enunciate a word and your tongue touches the top of your mouth, children born with a cleft palate have a hole in that top part of their mouth. So that surgery here in Canada, you know, definitely is happening before 18 months. In other parts of the world, you know, we have adults living with huge open palates because they were never able to access that surgery to repair that issue.
So, of course, language formation starts really, really early. In fact, some people say it starts in the womb, but because we hear sounds, they're impacting us, music, all kinds of things. So catching this very, very early on ensures that there's no, this is the whole thing, Chrissy. Our language has changed so much. I don't even know if we can use the word impediment anymore, can we?
We say impairment or impediment, words we don't like, I could say, or things like deformity or giving a child a smile, because these children are born with beautiful smiles already. Mm. We're just helping them get a new smile and have an improvement in their quality of life through having those surgeries. So, yes, speech starts very, very young. If we're able to get to children before age one, we still do provide speech therapy.
I was going to ask if there's after operation experiences.
Yeah, part of our sort of unique thing that we provide as Operation Smile is really a full spectrum of care. So everything from nutrition support before surgery, as I mentioned, lots of kids and babies come to us who are malnourished and therefore not healthy enough to get surgery. We provide nutritional support. And all the way through to speech pathology, psychosocial support, everything that they're going to need, as they grow with us, and we support them throughout all those processes. And often it's, we do a really great job at marketing that smile and that initial surgery, but often children born with cleft conditions need multiple surgeries.
I wanted to ask that question, Chrissy, because I don't think it's probably just one, right? It's deal with the lips perhaps first, or I don't know the order of operations for operations.
Yeah, so typically if we had a child who was brought to us as an infant, typically they would get their lip surgery first and then the palate surgery would come next. But as children grow, there can be other issues affecting their, so for example, their nasal passages. Yes. We would do rhinoplasties. There's ENT concerns. Sometimes we do bone grafting.
You just said ENT. You used was that ears, nose, and throat?
So, yeah, the ear, nose, and throat doctors, we use them because there can be issues with their ears, sort of all that stuff that's connected in your face. All of those things can be affected by a cleft condition, and typically children do get multiple surgeries if they stay with us, and all of that is provided, free and safe surgery is the thing that we pride ourselves on being able to provide to children who otherwise wouldn't have access to any care.
Let's ask that question, because you talked about ultrasounds. When typically would this show up in a normal pattern of investigation? Would we see this in week 14? Would we see it in week 24? What's and also you're going to have to tell me, what's the trigger for this?
Well, I'm not a doctor, Hugh. I'm just a fundraiser, so I don't have all the answers. However,
not just you are a fundraiser. You are doing the right thing.
I can tell you that in the communities we serve, sometimes it is showing up on ultrasounds if the parents have access to that kind of medical care. Many times they're finding out when the child is born. In a lot of the communities we serve, people are not, have never been to a hospital, have never accessed a doctor in their lives. We also have outreach programs just to explain what cleft conditions are to communities, to let them know that this is something that can be fixed. Even to bring them awareness about what it is called, for example. Yes. So in some of our communities, it's just not even something that parents even know exists or that there's an opportunity to have it fixed. And then the second part of your question, I forget. What was it?
You're right.
Well, the causes.
The causes of it. I just asked too many questions.
No, that's your job. We do know a few things that we believe cause cleft conditions. So one thing we know certainly is there is a genetic component. Some conditions are caused because one of the parents carries a gene that causes the cleft condition to happen. We have done some extensive research into smoke inhalation. So in developed countries, it's typically cigarette smoke. And in middle and lower income countries, what we've been noticing a lot is smoke inhalation from indoor cooking. Smoke or cook stoves, without ventilation. So that is a big risk factor. And then there's some others, water pollutants, other kind of environmental factors. And then some we just don't know yet. We're just not there in the research to know.
Well, 2024, exactly, maybe in 2055, we'll have more. I have to, when you talk about dealing with other countries, we also have a perhaps situation within our own country that has people who are somewhat diminished in their ability to access care. I'm talking about First Nations communities. Are you dealing with First Nations communities as well?
We don't do work in Canada. Our programs are in lower and middle income countries.
You did say that at the beginning, but I just wanted to ask because, of course, we did identify that Canada still, we're not immune to this. So our systems, our healthcare systems, deal with this.
They would have access through other programs, and there's some other charities that provide, you know, free transportation and things like that.
Yes.
But typically, regardless of where you are, whether you're in Sudbury or you're in Lucini or more remote, you would be coming down to one of the children's hospitals to get treatment. Yeah.
Okay.
And I mean, those are tough situations, but compared to, you know, children living in some low income countries, it's still a great option compared to what other people have.
It's just that
we have people traveling 20 hours by bus to try to access care.
It just seems that especially today, 2024, we seem to have our own low-income population who may not be as aware of some of the possibilities. I guess when a child reaches school age in Canada and there's still issues, I don't even know if I can use that word, challenges, the teachers, the staff, the school board gets involved as well. I think things have changed a lot in Canada. Let's turn to the other countries, and maybe I'm going to turn back the clock for how did you get involved in this?
That's a great question. So I was looking for a new opportunity and I saw just a job ad, and I started looking into the charity. So I think one thing about the fundraising field is you have to really be passionate about the cause that you're raising money for and believe in what you're doing. And I remember going through the Operation Smile Canada website and finding one of the videos with our founder, Bill McGee, speaking, and he said, "What if it was your child?"
Uh-huh.
And that really turned it for me, because here we have so much access, and then, you know, it varies. Obviously, if you're living in downtown Toronto, you have better access to healthcare than somebody in Sudbury, and we have better access than somebody living in, you know, a remote northern community.
Ketchikan, for example, yes.
Yeah, or, you know, many other places. So, however, you as a parent would fight and do everything you could do to get your child access to the care that they need. And in the countries we work in, Hugh, it's just not even a possibility. It's so beyond reach for parents. And I just imagined being in their shoes and thought, this is an organization I could get behind. And then we went through the process. And the last thing that really turned it for me was our CEO, Mark Climie Elliott. He and I were having a heart-to-heart. And you have to imagine, this is, you know, there's still a lot of COVID shutdowns and things like that happening around this time. And I had told him, "Mark, I have to be really upfront. I have a 2.5-year-old daughter at home. We do not have daycare. We've been on the list for years, but because of COVID and the backlog that created, she's still at home. And I want you to know that before you sign on the dotted line to hire me, that there could be interruptions throughout the day, and I won't."
And he said, "Have you heard of remote work or hybrid?"
Yeah, well, I mean, it was always a remote job, but what he did say was, "We're a family first organization." And, you know, we're here for the children and the families, but we're also here for each other and our families. And that is something, he not only walks the walk, but he walks the walk as well. And that has continued on over the 3 years that I've been with Operation Smile.
But at some time you've actually had contact, you've gone to, is the head office in Toronto or somewhere else?
Yeah, here in Canada, our offices are in Toronto, but my job is national. So I do travel from time to time, but typically it's to meet with partners and donors and and speak with them, although I do get to the office here and there. We're on University Avenue downtown.
Exactly. You know, it's massively important that we as Canadians, as a rich country, do share some of our wealth, our experience, our education, our healthcare with other countries. Have you been overseas yet? And is there love that just explodes into, you know, like you're just like you're almost overwhelmed by this whole thing?
Yeah, I had the opportunity to go to Paraguay and see our programs in action and watch a couple surgeries in the OR, and I am overwhelmed by so many things. The families that trust us with their children, and again, like a perspective there being many of these families have never been in a hospital, have never been under care of a doctor ever, and they're handing over their precious children and trusting us. The volunteers, of course, these people are phenomenal individuals who are, you know, if they're international volunteers coming from Canada, the US, Europe, they're taking their vacation days, they're busy medical professionals taking their vacation days to give their time and spend a long day serving others. And then we have 80% of our volunteers are local actually as mm-hmm. well. So when I was in Paraguay, one of the stories that really has always stuck with me is one of the anesthesiologists said, "Do you know about the nurses?" And I said, "No, tell me about the nurses." And he said, "These nurses not only volunteer their time, but they're paying colleagues to take their shifts at the hospital so that they can be here. And not just switching shift, but giving an extra incentive to pay their colleagues to take their shift so that they could come and volunteer their time with Operation Smile and help children in need." And you have to keep in mind that these nurses in Paraguay are not making $100,000 a year. Like, these are lower income people who are giving everything they have to make sure kids have a chance at a better life. And it's pretty overwhelming. They love Canada.
No kidding.
We help their entire program there in Paraguay, and they had lots of gratitude for us, but my gratitude is for them because they're the ones on the ground in the field helping kids every day and organizing these really complex surgical programs and making sure everything goes smoothly and safely and that there's the best possible outcome for the children who are in need.
I know that Orbis has a plane and they go and do eye surgery, cataract surgery around the world, but by sending these by them volunteering to go, is some of the knowledge shared with local medical professionals, the nursing staff, the rest of it, so they know the procedure and they can go, "Hey, look, I know how to do this now. I'm going to replicate this hundreds of times."
Yeah, that's one of the amazing things, again, about Operation Smile. And I could talk, I love this organization, Hugh. I could talk about it for days. But we were founded in 1982 by Bill and Kathy McGee, who Bill was a resident plastic surgeon, and he went to the Philippines with Kathy, who was a nurse, also his wife, with about enough equipment and supplies to help 40 children, and hundreds of families showed up. So they committed themselves to keep going back year after year until there was no need, and they're still with the organization. You know,
wow.
I won't call them out on their age, but if you do the math at 1982 to yes. now, you know, we're over 40 years. And one of the things that we've committed to do, that they committed to do, we're training people in the local countries that we serve, helping governments, helping universities, and making sure that there's being local capacity being built. So we're not just a fly in, swoop in, save people, fly out organization. Go. We're building global capacity and responding to communities in the way that they need it most. And that really saved us during the pandemic because we've been training people in the field for many, many mm-hmm. years. A lot of our programs could continue when travel was not possible or later when travel was restricted. Because if you imagine a surgeon in Canada was, you know, even if they had the time during the heat of the pandemic when everybody was so taxed on their time, to be able to come back and then isolate for 2 weeks was just not something that was really possible. So we leaned hard on our local volunteers and were able to continue some surgeries and care during the pandemic. And we're really proud of that. And we're continuing to invest in education in a number of countries. A great example is Rwanda. When we first partnered with some folks in Rwanda, they had one plastic surgeon for their entire country. I think there are about 17 million people. I should get my facts down before I started talking. But so one plastic surgeon. So a plastic surgery, if you burned yourself or had another really bad accident, you're waiting about 5 years if you could afford it, if you had access to that main hospital. We're training plastic surgeons in Rwanda right now. I think we have, there's five total now, and we're hoping to get that number up over the next few years as well. So those capacity building things, the building health systems and helping health systems in these countries are what's really the game changer. So again, our marketing team does a wonderful job showing the beautiful smiles and the impact, that immediate impact we have on children's lives. But the long game here for us is helping countries build their health systems so that they can do this on their own, and that children and people everywhere have access to essential surgery without us having to be part of the picture. So that's the long game.
Are you are you a team leader in the fundraising part of all of this then? Do you have a group of people who report to you, and at the same time you do the more corporate, the more the larger donor nourishing, I guess?
So my title is Vice President of Philanthropy, and I do have a team that works under me. And the areas of fundraising that check in with me are plan giving. So yes, we have a lot of really generous folks who leave us in their will or part of their estate plan, and, mm-hmm. and that works under me as well. And then, yes, the larger gifts, corporate giving, as well as what we call our mid-level program. So that is all our wonderful donors who are making, you know, what's a large gift to them in the annual capacity, right, also is reporting into to.
But you can use Canada Helps as an individual, and probably you're on one of the lists that they have.
Yeah, you certainly can use Canada Helps. It's a method of giving for sure. You can give directly on our website.
Tell us about it. Tell us how to give directly.
Sure, yeah. You can go to operationsmile.ca, and there's a number of options to give, either a one-time gift or a monthly gift. We also, how a lot of people know about us is our television commercials. So people would have seen those, and there's a phone number there. You can reach out to me directly. I don't have, our 1-800 number is, you know, 1-844-376-4530. That's our office number. People could call in to make a gift there as well.
Can you say that again? Just say that number
again.
Because
okay,
people have got their pens ready.
Yeah, you got your pens? Okay. It's 1-844-376-4530. That's our office's toll-free phone number you can call in. Also, Christy Russo at operationsmile.org if anybody wants to just talk more or learn more about their programs. But it's a very special charity. Mm-hmm. It has a very special place in my heart and in many, many Canadians' hearts. So we know that there's a lot of folks giving here in Sudbury and across the country. And we couldn't do it without our donors, our partners. That's the key.
You sure? You know, before we actually started this interview, Christy showed me a photo of a young boy named Nicholas, I believe.
Yeah. Nicholas.
Can you
from
just
Guatemala.
Talk a little bit about Nicholas and his situation and why you're? I mean, he looks so happy. Is that? I mean, when you say Project Smile, it's really Project All Your Face Exploding in Happiness, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, he's a little guy who was lucky enough to get his surgery when he was pretty young. And the before and after picture that I had showed you had him, I think the baby photo, I think he was 3 or 4 months old. And then when he was holding his picture, so his child picture, he was 4 years old and he had access to surgery. And I mean, the children have beautiful smiles both before and after surgery, but when they get a chance to look in the mirror and see the results, you know, that's a game changer. And of course, for the younger kids, the parents, when they get to see the results, and it's phenomenal. One of the programs we've been sharing on television lately is Jeanette's story. And this is something another a donor here at Sudbury had talked to me about. And I think about that often too, is even just the impact of, we have a small device that children can put into their mouths, into babies' mouths, called a NAM, and it blocks the hole in their mouth and it blocks the hole in their lip so that they can eat. And that relief that Jeanette's mom and the other moms have when that happens, where their baby can now properly feed and the crying stops and they know their babies are being nourished, those are the moments you live for, right? Those are the moments that make all this worth it, is that baby's saved and we can keep going.
Oh my goodness. You know, I'm going to reach out to the audience here and say to you, if you know that maybe you have the ability to support Project Smile, you should do this today. Right now, as you listen to this program, go onto the internet and find Project Smile and read. I imagine there's a splash page and multiple pages that explain what's going on and share some stories. Are there videos? There are probably some videos as well.
Yeah, there's tons of videos. So again, it's Operation Smile, operationsmile.ca if you're in Canada. And our YouTube page as well has a whole bunch of the videos. Tells the stories of children from around the world that have been helped through the donations of other Canadians and other people around the world who just care and care for these children.
Well, so, I'm delighted that you're doing what you're doing and doing it successfully, because that is essential to making a charity work, and to make, beyond all of this, to provide children with a sense of hope, a sense of well-being. And what you do, Christy Russo, is essential to, I think, Canadians' way of understanding the world and how we're placed in the world. So I say thank you, and on behalf of the audience, gosh.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to share a bit of our story here at Operation Smile, and to make sure that, you know, to get the message out that we just have gratitude for all of you who do give, and anyone who's considering giving. And we couldn't do it without our great medical volunteers and our donors. Those are the people making the difference. I'm just a connector.
And we have to thank the Sudbury Public Library System, because there you are on the way out. There I am on the way in. I think, you know, if we go beyond community, the larger community, just the local community, the library is an essential part. And look at what it's done. It's drawn you and I together to have this conversation.
Love the library. Our family are big library users. We always will be. So, yeah, shout out to those folks.
Public libraries.
Especially the South End location. We are very happy there.
Well, Christy Russo, thank you so much from Project Smile, Operation Smile. Operation Smile. I don't know why I keep calling it Project Smile. But anyways, Operation Smile. Christy Russo is available to you. You've heard how to reach her. You go searching. And, you know, if you've been listening to this program asynchronously, it's a podcast available for you. Just Google my name, Hugh Cruzell, and the word podcast. If you've been listening on Thursdays at 6 o'clock, CKLU 96.7. Again, those of you in the larger world, use Radio Garden. Rotate the globe. You can be anywhere in the world, and you can listen to CKLU 96.7. Christy Russo, thank you so much from Operation Smile.
Thank you, Hugh.